I'm Scott.
And I'm Jason. Welcome to Skipped on Shuffle, a podcast where we delve into an overlooked song by a popular artist.
Today's episode is going to be on The Love Thieves by Depeche Mode from their album Ultra. Arms for the poor, for the wretched disciples, and the love that they swore with their hearts on the Bible, beseeching the
Welcome to Skipped on Shuffle. Okay, so today we're looking at the band Depeche Mode and the song The Love Thieves, which is off of their 1997 album Ultra, which was their ninth studio album. So definitely a lot of music, a lot of history there to talk about. A lot of people maybe a lot like myself, where I kind of came to Depeche Mode later as a fan. I wasn't too familiar with a lot of their tracks, obviously. Things like Enjoy the Silence, Personal Jesus, things where, you know, when I'd hear them, I'd be like, oh, I know that song. And eventually I was able to put together, oh, that's Depeche Mode. And then kind of went into it from there. I remember sitting in the car, listening to the radio and walking in my shoes came on. And I remember being like, oh, this is a really cool song. And then I put together, oh, this is also Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
So my interest kind of grew incrementally. And I mean, they had already been around for a while. So, you know, I was probably only coming into this 7-8 years ago. So I had to play kind of a lot of catch up in listening to the band.
Yeah. So my dad was a huge fan, and he was actually in like an 80s synth pop kind of act, where he was like the primary songwriter or whatever. They didn't do anything. I think like they played like one show and released one like little EP kind of thing, and then that was it. But he was always a big fan of the kind of music that Depeche Mode was making. So when I was growing up, like Depeche Mode was just everywhere. Like I heard it all the time. You know, I'd already memorized the track listing for Black Celebration by the time I actually bought like my first copy of a Depeche Mode record. So Depeche Mode has always been a huge thing for me. So obviously, I'm only 35. So when I was born when their third album came out. So obviously I had to catch up a little bit, but I mean, the concept of Depeche Mode being a band and producing great music was always a part of my life. So, but it wasn't until like when I was younger, when I was just starting to get into music, I really felt that like if there wasn't a prominent heavy guitar track, then it wasn't for me. So I kind of rebelled against Depeche Mode for a little bit. But then when I started becoming like more interested in songwriting, that's when I sort of attached myself to the band because the songs are just written so well. Martin Gore is such an amazing songwriter, that it was easy to sort of like see into that, even though there wasn't that many guitars at the beginning, at least. So.
Yeah, I think that was probably a lot of my hesitation in listening to it. You know, being probably middle school kid,
yeah,
snobbish that, oh, if it's not rock music with heavy guitars,
it's not real if it's not heavy rock and roll, man.
So that did probably keep me away from it for a while. But I mean, I do remember hearing the name Depeche Mode a lot. It's just funny that it took me so long to connect it to the music.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I remember kind of is just going through music stores, looking through albums, always seeing kind of Depeche Mode prominently displayed. And one thing I've always liked is kind of their album cover designs,
yeah,
and especially the logo changing every album.
Yeah.
I think probably if you're a graphic designer, a graphic artist, you would probably be like, oh, these Depeche Mode, you know, covers are kind of interesting the way they do some of their stuff. And also in the tradition of a lot of 80s bands with the coming of MTV, a lot of videos as well to help them promote their albums.
Yeah, and they have such an iconic look, you know, with Dave Gahn, the lead singer, you know, being this lanky, gothy weirdo, and then you've got Martin Gore, who is literally one of the weirdest little men that you've ever seen in your life, and then Andy Fletcher, who's like the super tall, you know, kind of geeky guy, and then Alan Wilder, who's kind of like a biker, you know, kind of looks like a greaser almost from Grease or something.
It was very interesting.
Yeah, just a cool look, a cool vibe, and a cool sound. Just cool. Like, I think that when I think of Depeche Mode, I think of cool. I think of cool music written by cool people. But most people do not think that at all. Most people, when they hear the word Depeche Mode, or, you know, the band name Depeche Mode, they think of lots of negative things. You know, they think of like weirdos. They think of like, I don't know, like, what's a good word for it? Like, I don't know, like pretentious, maybe.
Maybe. I mean, there's something about when you mention, if someone was to ask you, oh, who are Depeche Mode? And you start with, well, they're like 80s synth band, and immediately your mind goes to
Flock of Seagulls.
The worst of the, like, that really throwaway garbage, you know, songs with the crappy sounding Casio keyboard. I think that's probably where you go.
Yeah.
And because you connect to that, you know, that idea to that sound, then you're just kind of like, oh, okay, it's that kind of throwaway. Like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to tell me anymore. I get it.
Right. So I think that there is kind of this negative connotation, and it's certainly in media. There's definitely, you know, this, it's kind of an underground movie, but there's a movie called Orgasmo, which was made by the guys who developed South Park. And in the movie, there's this character who is clearly gay, but doesn't want to admit that he's gay. And the joke is that every now and then throughout the movie, he'll say something that, and he'll preface it with being like, I don't want to sound gay or anything, but, and then he'll say something that clearly is gay. And one of the things he says in the movie is, I don't want to sound queer or nothing, but I think Depeche Mode's a really good band. And, like, you know, I mean, obviously that's stupid. It's a South Park thing, you know, South Park guys, it's just this crude
just
humor.
Just to get people, riled up.
But just get people riled up. But the point is that, like, from a mainstream music perspective, especially in America, Depeche Mode is a gay band. It's a band of weird music that's for sissy boys or whatever, you know, or, you know, raver girls, or it doesn't have like this mainstream connotation to it. But like, if you look at the stats of Depeche Mode, Depeche Mode is one of the biggest bands ever. Like, I mean, they just recently, just this past year, sold out Madison Square Garden, like, you know, like the one of the biggest and most prominent arenas in the world. So it's like, they're still huge, you know, 40 years after their first album came out. And, you know, clearly there's something going on here that keeps them so vibrant with people, and so vibrant with even younger people today. So there is something about there, we're weird, you know, we're different. And that still draws in people from, you know, old people who have been listening to them for decades, and then newer people who are just discovering their music. I think it's a really interesting band to be so quote unquote mainstream when it comes to certain statistical things that you look at, like their ticket sales and their prominence in music history and all that, but then still so underground when it comes to, especially here in America, their you know, their mainstream appeal.
Being a British band.
Yeah.
I wonder if part of that appeal that they've managed to sustain is because they kind of hit so many different audiences, where you might be into that kind of synth electronic music. I mean, they certainly have tracks that sound like kind of like a house music.
Yeah. Or, like with the driving, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Beat, and they do a lot of remixes of their music as well, which is a whole nother way that, that people end up connecting to them. So you have that whole element. You have the people who, like you and I, really enjoy them as songwriters. You have a whole nother group of people where they've, you know, kept that kind of goth, style, where even though they're not still that way anymore.
Yeah, they work in sales.
But I mean, they've still managed to retain some kind of persona connected with, you know, we tend to write some dark, brooding music.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think they're able to draw on a lot of people, because I remember my first time going to see Depeche Mode when they were touring in 2013, going and seeing a lot of people like dressed in black.
Yeah. Just all goth stuff.
Funny to see, because, you know, I remember that being a big thing when I was in high school and I feel like I haven't seen it like, that was the most recent sighting this is still a thing.
That show was probably their time. And they were like, we're going to do this. We're going to get our blackout. We're going to put on our eyeliner. We're going to go to this Depeche Mode concert. And it's probably the one or two times a year that they get to do that. Yeah. That they get to relive that culture, you know? And, And Depeche Mode, you know, they do a great job of like with their set list. They do a great job of acknowledging their past and playing a lot of their bigger songs from the past, but also still playing some of their newer material. And I feel like for those people that you saw at that concert, like that's one of the biggest nights of the year for them is like going to one of these concerts. And so it truly is like a cultural milestone to be a Depeche Mode fan. It's a part of who you are in a certain way, either as a response, because you are kind of a disaffected person who doesn't feel connected to the world, you know, as well as maybe some more mainstream people would, or just because you want to be that outcast. And Depeche Mode finds a person, you know, finds people like that really, really well. So I want to talk about the history of Depeche Mode a little bit. Now this is a band. Their first album came out in 1981. So we're talking a long time. So I don't want to go too deep into it, but I want to give a basic refresher for people who maybe aren't Depeche Mode fans to give an idea of like where they came from. So their first album, 1981, came out, Speak and Spell. Almost exclusively written by Vince Clarke, who came up with the sound and the look and kind of created Depeche Mode, you know, with his other three members. And they released this one record, had one big, huge hit on it called Just Can't Get Enough. And then he left the group and obviously wasn't the songwriter anymore, which meant that Martin Gore, who was a member of the group at the time, had to take over the songwriting duties, which he had never really predominantly written songs before. So you just have to imagine like being in a band, the songwriter leaving, and then somebody coming and be like, guess what? You're the songwriter.
And you had a hit.
And you had a hit.
Like
yeah.
you're off and running.
Yeah. And the hit that they had was very cheesy, almost like a novelty song. It sounds like it's a song from like a Sega Genesis video game or something like that. It's very Casio, like kind of what you were mentioning before, like that. So they had this song that was very defining for their group and then had to realize, okay, well, we can either try and catch that again or we can go off in a different direction. And I think that, you know, Martin Gore essentially was like, we're going to go off in a different direction. So Just Can't Get Enough, big hit. Then they have three records that come out, 1982, 1983, 1984. So bam, 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 one record after the other each year. A Broken Frame, Construction Time Again, and Some Great Reward. There were big songs on here too. There was Blasphemous Rumors, that was kind of a big hit. There was Master and Servant, also kind of a big hit.
People Are People.
People Are People. You know, like there were some songs on there that were like 80s touchstones, but nothing that really like made any huge waves. And I think a part of that is because Martin Gore was kind of, you know,
figure things out.
Yeah, like I've never done this before. Now I have to sort of figure this out. So they released three records and everything was going
and kept
well.
In that vein of experimenting with sound.
Yeah.
Some have some weird, you know, it just sounds like, oh, is that a hammer in the background? You know, there's a lot of strange stuff going on some of these tracks.
Yeah.
And not only trying to figure out how to write a song, but also what should we be sounding like? You know, does this sound cutting edge? Are people interested in us because of, you know, these quirky kind of sounds? Are we that synth band or are we something else? And I think, yeah, a lot of that set of albums, that trio of albums, was working that out.
And, you know, you have to remember that a lot of bands, they figure this all out of the spotlight. Like they figure this all out in their garage as they're sort of developing into the band that they're going to be. But Depeche Mode, they, you know, he kind of had to do it in the spotlight because like you said, they'd already had that big hit. So people were already coming to their shows, already watching them, already watching their videos and getting into them. And he had to sort of figure out like what the band was going to be. It wasn't until 1986 with Black Celebration that they really developed who they were. And as for me, and I'm sure a lot of Depeche Mode fans out there, like Black Celebration is where it starts. You know, like, yeah, there are four albums before Black Celebration, but I mean, I don't really listen to them that much. I'll pop on a couple of the singles here and there. People Are People is one of my favorites, and you know, that kind of thing. But really, if somebody says like, where do I begin with Depeche Mode? Ignore their first four records and just start with Black Celebration.
Yeah, it was hard for me as I kind of worked my way backwards, and when I got to that gap between when Black Celebration came out, and then Some Great Reward, you realize, oh, something big happened in the middle of that. Yeah, and I agree. I barely ever listened to anything before Black Celebration.
Yeah, so Black Celebration was their big breakthrough, where their sound was not concrete, because they've always sort of flowed, but they got a grip on like who they were as a band. And Martin Gore really blossomed as a songwriter, and that's when they started to get, you know, big. They were starting to become like this, like, you know, this 80s icon almost. And then Music for the Masses came out, which was even bigger. Like, they got even bigger. That's when they started bringing guitar tracks into things. The whole album opens on a guitar track, which was the first time anybody had heard a guitar played in a Depeche Mode song. So, like, they were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that tour for Music for the Masses actually saw them playing their biggest concert ever at the Rose Bowl for 65,000 people, which is a lot. I mean, we're talking a football stadium packed to the brim with goth kids in the 80s jamming out to Depeche Mode. I mean, this was huge. This not only solidified them as like a music industry giant that was making a ton of money, but also is like, you know, a lot of people were like, you know, Depeche Mode, what? And then all of a sudden they're like 65,000 people.
It becomes hard to ignore.
Yeah, you can't ignore that anymore. You know, that's a lot. That's a huge thing. I mean, you know, the Beatles were filling those kinds of arenas when they were touring. So, I mean, it's just like, that was just, you know, this monumental thing. And then after all of this, they finally get around to releasing Violator, which has all the songs that everybody knows by Depeche Mode, which is Enjoy the Silence and Personal Jesus and a bunch of other singles that came out of there.
Policy of Truth,
you know, all these ones that they are Depeche Mode staples. You go to a concert by Depeche Mode, they're going to play these songs, you know. And then even the ones that are like fan favorites, like Waiting for the Night, all these things, that was all of a sudden they were just so big. They were huge. Not only were they on the radio all the time now, they were touring these giant places. There were videos everywhere. I mean, they were just enormous. And then they did the Songs of Faith and Devotion album, which came out in 1993. And music history buffs will know that 1993, we're already in Nirvana. Nirvana has already come along. You know, grunge is huge. Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins, they've all released their first or second records by this time. And Depeche Mode is kind of being sort of thrown to the side. So Dave Gahan, the lead singer of Depeche Mode, he actually grows his hair out. He starts to look a lot more like Chris Cornell from Soundgarden. Yeah. He starts like wearing kind of like grungier clothes, and also gets into the grunge drug of choice, which is heroin. He becomes total junkie, you know, basically drugged out of his mind 24 hours a day. And, you know, they're still touring, they're still functioning as a band, but things are starting to go wrong. They got too big. They were just too big. He was stretched too thin. He was unable to function without being pumped full of some sort of drug.
And the Depeche Mode cycle tends to be, or at least for, pretty much Songs of Faith and Devotion moving forward, is, you know, a cycle of release an album, do a big tour.
Yep.
So they had been doing this a little bit. I mean, the albums were coming out a little bit quicker back in the day, 3 years in between.
Yeah.
Some of these albums, but you figure in terms of trying to write a whole album, record a whole album, do a major world tour, because that's, I mean, they were doing big tours.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising, you know, that amount of,
it just
that
pace. Cave.
Yeah. That amount of pressure.
So, it all came to a screeching halt when in, 1993, during the Songs of Faith and Devotion tour, Dave Gahan actually collapsed after a concert. They were in between songs, so it was an encore. You know, they were off the stage and the crowd was cheering, come back and play more. And Dave Gahan actually collapsed and had a heart attack. And it was drug induced. It was not, I mean, he was young. He was not having an age heart attack. Yeah. He was having a drug heart attack. And that kind of brought the tour to a screeching halt. Things started to go bad. Then in 1995, he actually attempted to commit suicide. He slashed his wrist, and he left a note and called some people before he did it, which made it so that he was pretty much guaranteed to be rescued. And even he himself, Dave Gahan himself, he actually says that it was a legit suicide attempt. He was trying to kill himself, but he sort of set it up subconsciously so that he knew he would be saved. So the band's a mess. Like, the lead singer's a mess. The band's going wrong, whatever. Suddenly, in the middle of 1996, Alan Wilder, who is one of the founding members of the band, leaves. Now, during interviews and all this stuff, he said that he left because of creative differences and issues with the band's management and all this other stuff. But it's hard to ignore the fact that the band was in shambles due to Dave Gahan's drug use and the issues that was causing.
Mm. And at the time he left, the band was getting into trying to make a new album.
Yeah, right.
And Alan Wilder is, as we mentioned with Martin Gore earlier, not traditionally a songwriter. Alan Wilder was kind of the music guy.
Yeah.
He's classically trained. He plays a bunch of different instruments. So a lot of his contribution to the band was crafting the sound and kind of those nuances and that special kind of hard to describe, but when you hear Depeche Mode, you're like, this is
melodies,
this is what I'm familiar with. And
the melodies sort of cross each other and
these overlapping keyboards.
Exactly. And that's all Alan Wilder coming in and being like, we got to add this and do this or whatever, because, you know, Martin Gore is the primary songwriter who writes the basics of the song, demos them in his home or whatever. And then Dave Gahan is the voice and lead singer. And Alan Wilder was sort of like the studio wizard. In fact, he was quoted as saying that he loved being in the studio, loved it more than anything. That was his favorite time to be in a band, and the rest of the band hates being in the studio. They could care less. They just want to get the tracks down so they can go on tour. You know, Depeche Mode, like you said, they do these big tours is because they all love to tour. They love being on stage. They love the live audience feel. And Alan Wilder was kind of the opposite. He really liked just being in the studio and creating these weird sounds and developing music.
And especially when you hear, if you've ever heard, Depeche Mode has had some releases where they've released demo tracks.
Yeah.
And even nowadays, the more recent albums, the Martin Gore demo tracks are very rough.
Very rough.
Like some kind of drum machine, maybe a guitar
like it was all
or something.
Done on his phone or something.
But yeah. And I mean, they sound like, like, where did you record this?
Yeah.
So it's very clear what Alan Wilder brought to the band.
Yeah.
And I think the, you know, reaction of the band trying to figure it out on top of all those other problems.
Yeah.
You know, I can imagine the kind of crisis of identity where, you know.
So that's where we are. And now Ultra is coming out, which has got The Love Thieves on it, which is the song we're going to cover today. So the band has gone through so much and they've lost a member. Their lead singer is totally messed up on drugs. And I haven't mentioned this yet, but Martin Gore was also he was seriously an alcoholic. He was drinking from the moment he got up to the moment he went to sleep. And the band's just a total mess. And, they have to make this next record. Like, the record label's like, you know, what's up, guys? You know, you did this big record, you did this big tour, what's next? What are we going to do next? And so originally they decided they were going to make an EP. They were just like, let's just get back in the studio. Now that Alan Wilder's not here, let's get back in the studio and just sort of like get reacquainted with being in the studio again and doing this kind of stuff. And it turned out that Martin Gore had a lot of great material. So they were like, oh no, we've got enough to do a whole record here. Let's just go ahead and do it. But unfortunately, Dave Gahan just wasn't up to it. And everything came to a screeching halt with the recording of the record when he actually had an overdose, a speedball overdose. And speedball is actually when you mix heroin and cocaine together. So, I mean, he just totally messed up. So he actually died, like legitimately died, and then was resuscitated back to life. I don't remember exactly how long he was dead for, but I think it was several minutes of death, of flatline death. And he was resuscitated just like in Pulp Fiction when Uma Thurman gets stabbed in the chest with the needle right into the heart. Like, he had an adrenaline shot pumped into his heart, and that's what brought him back to life. So, you just have to imagine, like, what it must be like being in a band this fucked up right now and then trying to make a record at the same time. Like, it's just crazy. So Dave gone, he's resuscitated, and this was the wake-up call he needed. He went to rehab, he got himself clean and worked his way back into being in the group, and then they finished this record, Ultra, and that was that. So, huge mess. This is, without a doubt, this album represents the darkest period for Depeche Mode. Mm. Everything after this, pretty standard. You know, Dave gone is clean. There's been some personal things. There was a divorce, which influenced a lot of Martin's future songwriting after this record. There was some, you know, they all have kids and the kids are coming of age and that's causing them, like, you know, issues as being like parents and sort of reflecting on the world.
But never anything so much of we can't get through this recording and we can't finish this tour even. Yeah.
Our lead singer's dying. Yeah. Our band members are leaving. Nothing like this. This is the darkest, most turbulent time of Depeche Mode. And this album, Ultra, is the result of that turbulent time. And it's a really interesting record because of that history that goes along with it. And it translates a little bit into the songs. Not so much in the song that we're going to go over today, The Love Thieves. I think The Love Thieves is a little bit more subdued and somber of a track. But there are definitely a few tracks on here, especially It's No Good, Barrel of a Gun. You know, very just like dirty, grindy, kind of sludgy songs that kind of represent where the band was going at the time. But that's what's going on at the time period when this song The Love Thieves comes out.
With their hearts on the Bible, beseeching the honor to sit at your table and feast on your holiness as long as they're.
Okay, so we're looking specifically at The Love Thieves off of the Ultra album. It's really interesting where it comes in the track listing for the album in the sequencing, because you have Barrel of a Gun, which, as you mentioned, it's a gritty rock song with heavy guitar, and then all of a sudden we're kind of pulled back with The Love Thieves, which is the second track. Also a lengthy track, over 6 minutes long, 6.5 minutes. And a very, as you mentioned, somber song. It's got very subdued programming and electronics. It's not as flashy as the Depeche Mode we were used to with things like Black Celebration and Violator, Music for the Masses.
Big beats, big parts, big loud, hooky choruses kind of thing.
Yeah, this almost goes in the complete opposite direction. So I think one of my favorite parts about The Love Thieves is that subdued instrumentation that Dave Gahan, it really makes his vocal stand out on the track.
Yeah.
I feel like his vocal is really the centerpiece of that track.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of Depeche Mode's thing. So, like, I mentioned this a little earlier, but to give like a very clear definition of what each band member does, Dave Gahan is the lead singer, and that's all he does up until Playing the Angel comes out in 2005. Dave Gahan never writes a song, never writes a part, never does anything. All he does is record his lead vocals and then be the front man during live shows. And then Martin Gore writes all the songs and does backing vocals and also sings lead vocals on some of the songs on the records. And then, as we mentioned, Alan Wilder and Andy Fletcher, they kind of add in parts and, you know, sort of develop like the atmosphere of the album and sort of, you know, take care of all the stuff that needs to get done after the two main aspects are done. So, I mean, Dave Gahan is coming in and singing parts that Martin Gore has already written and just basically says, these are your parts to sing. So where he really needs to, you know, what he brings to the music is exactly what you're talking about, where it's that emotion that, for lack of a better word, for that pain. You know, that pain of emotion and that aesthetic that Depeche Mode songs kind of just have, in, you know, inherently.
Yeah, and I like a lot of the Martin, because Martin Gore will also sing vocals on some of the tracks, usually, you know, a couple per album. But there is certainly a very big difference between
huge
the singers, and Martin Gore tends to be a little, I don't want to say show tune-y. but I mean, he has a very distinct style that sounds a little bit more like something you'd hear in a more musical.
Yeah, he's got
kind of setting.
He's got a lot of vibrato. You know, his voice kind of.
It's a very booming kind of. Like you picture him standing in front of
in a tux. Yeah. And then Dave Gahn is not that. Dave Gahn is almost like a rock singer. You know, he's like a rock and roll singer who just happens to be fronting an electronic band
and can do a lot more with his voice. Yeah. He can kind of put some growl on it. He can. You know, make it really beautiful and smooth as he does on The Love Thieves.
Yep.
So I mean, if you want any kind of contrast of Dave Gahn vocals, all you have to do is listen to the first two tracks of Ultra.
You've got
the barrel of a gun. Yeah.
Yeah. At the beginning and then smoothing it out and becoming like this soulful balladeer on the second track. It is interesting that they're so close together like that. It really is showcasing like his
vocal
range.
Two sides. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, a lot of this album to me, and specifically The Love Thieves, that appeals to me is it sounds like a band trying to fix themselves.
Yeah.
Kind of starting over, getting kind of back to basics, where they're playing with really quiet, subtle sounds and electronics I can't really think of another track that they had released previous to this that comes anywhere close to sounding anything like this song does.
Yeah, even the previous record, Songs of Faith and Devotion, like it did have quieter songs on it, but they were much more, they're bigger. They just had a bigger sound. It was like a ballad meant for an arena, whereas this, I feel like, is meant for a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Like this is like a song.
It finds this quiet groove and it stays there and it doesn't, it almost, and you wonder in them doing the writing if they were wondering, well, are we ever going to have to care about performing the song live?
Yeah,
we might never need to, because that's kind of the state that the band was at, where you were kind of wondering, you know, where are we going from here? Right. Who are we now?
Yeah. And there was actually talk. There's a documentary that was released with the remastered version of this album that came out a few years ago. And in the documentary, they actually discussed that the thought was brought up to make this entire album a Martin Gore solo record instead of a Depeche Mode record, which would mean that Dave Gahn wouldn't appear on it because he was so hard to get into the studio and get good work done. They were just going to have Martin Gore record all the vocals and just release it as a Martin Gore solo record, which to date he has never done. He's only done solo records where he covers other people's material. He's got an EP and then an album that's just him playing other people's songs and, you know, in a Depeche Mode kind of style. And then he has an atmospheric album that he released that's all instrumental and just weird noises and whatever. So, like, this would have been a huge thing. It would have been a huge step to have them be like, we're going to take Martin Gore songs, take Dave Gahn out, and put Martin Gore in and do that. So it might have been, like, because they were thinking that, they might have been like, we can do whatever we want. Like, we don't have to adhere to any kind of Depeche Mode formula, because this album might not even be a Depeche Mode album.
Mm.
So, you know, it's interesting to sort of hear, like you mentioned, Barrel of a Gun, and immediately followed by this track.
Yeah,
You
kind of wonder, was this more of a Martin Gore track
that
he had intended, you know, for himself?
Yeah.
And then Dave ended up being able to show up
and lay down a
great vocal.
Yeah. Once he got into rehab, he was there, he was cognizant, he was ready to go, he was ready to work. And they were like, oh no, we can pull this together. And they did. And, you know, maybe that has some sort of signification why this song sounds so different from a lot of their other stuff.
Mm.
As long as they're able. Martyrs need sacrifices. They live for your beauty and pay for their vices.
Lyrically, Martin Gore is constantly putting biblical and religious imagery into his songs, starting all the way back to, you know, the original albums that we're making right after Vince Clark left. And I think that, you know, this song is no stranger to that either. I mean, we've got references to Adam and Eve, we've got references to Jonah, and then we have like an overall feeling of like martyrdom, which obviously would reference just like Christ in general. And these are not topics that Martin Gore shies away from. He is constantly bringing faith and religion into Depeche Mode songs. And even their previous record in 1993 was Songs of Faith and Devotion. And a lot of those songs were him discussing the juxtaposition of faith and loyalty to Christ with faith and loyalty to your lover, your partner, your wife, your spouse, whatever the case may be. And this song is once again, it fits right into that Martin Gore religious love kind of mold. So for me, it sometimes gets difficult because I am not a religious person at all. And sometimes I listen to Depeche Mode songs and I think to myself, like, I can't really relate to this. You know, I listen to like something like off of Music for the Masses, there's a song called Sacred, which is similar in theme to this song where he talks about like how religion has missionaries and religion has churches and priests and all this stuff. And he is a missionary for love and sensuality and connection between him and other people. And I get to myself, I'm like, you know, I just can't get into it. Cause I'm just like, I just don't get into this whole religion thing. So I just kind of like, it makes me kind of zone out a little bit during tracks like that. But for whatever reason, it doesn't happen with this song. With this song, I think it actually brings me closer to understanding what he's trying to say. And the specific line that gets me is the very first line of the chorus, which is "Love needs its martyrs." And it really gets me thinking about, you know, sacrifice and relationships and love and, you know, failed relationships, breakups, all that stuff. The idea of love needing martyrs gets me thinking about the idea that there are people in your life that come in and then go. You know, maybe you have a relationship that only lasts a month or two, or maybe you have a relationship that lasts years, but ends really badly, divorces, whatever. And, you know, that person, and I think that this is what the song is trying to say, that person is a martyr. Like, they have martyred themselves, their love, in order for you to be able to continue on and build love with somebody else. And I think that that's what he's trying to get across here. And I think that bringing the religious imagery into it makes me understand that even more, because you understand like something like, you know, Christ sacrifices for the world and all that stuff, playing into the idea of relationships and love.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think you have also a lot of that kind of, there's hints at the kind of transaction that takes place.
That's a good word. I like that.
You know, he mentions with their love begging bowls, where, you know, there are people out there who, you know, are begging to be noticed and be loved. And I think the suggestion here is you need to give love in order to get love, which is also a lyric that appears on one of the later tracks on this album.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what he's hinting at here. There's another line: "They live for your beauty and pay for your vices."
Yes.
Again, very transactional. That, you know, I'm maybe like obsessed and head over heels with you, but that might come at a cost to myself or to you at some point in time. I think it's a little complex what he's saying. I think one of If I did have a complaint about his Martin Gore songwriting, is he doesn't make it too clear some of the times what he's saying. As good of a songwriter as he is, I think sometimes it gets a little confusing, and I don't know if he even knows for sure what he's trying to get across. Just kind of some of the comparisons he makes are a little strange, mentioning all the clerks and the tailors, the sharks and the sailors. You know, it's
yeah, that's kind of vague.
You're like, what are you saying? But yeah, I think there's something at the heart of the song is kind of in some kind of an understanding of you get love, and even that, if that love turns sour somewhere, you need to kind of pay it forward.
Yeah.
And be accepting of the love you received in that moment. You need to kind of cherish that. So if that love does sour or go wrong, that doesn't mean it was all worthless.
Yeah. And I like the word that you use, complex, to describe this song. And I think that's that, I do agree that, like, yeah, sometimes he does get a little convoluted and you're like, what are you even talking about here? Like, I don't really get this, you know? But I feel like with this song, I feel like this song is very rewarding. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to do this song for this episode. You know, because there's literally over 100 Depeche Mode songs that we could have done that, you know, are not major big hits. But this one really spoke to me because of its complexity, that the more you listen to it and the deeper you get into it, whether you're looking at the lyrics or the religious imagery, or even like you mentioned, like the songwriting and the general sound and production of the song, I feel like it constantly is giving me more. The more I listen to it, the more I get out of it. And the fact that it's, you know, 6 minutes and 34 seconds long,
it gives you a lot of time to
like, you know, figure that out. And I think that the complexity here pays off. And you're right. Sometimes the complexity of Martin Gore's lyrics and songwriting does not pay off. But sometimes, well, actually, I will say a lot of the time, there is no complexity. You know, like a song like Enjoy the Silence is very direct. It's very simple. Like, all I've ever wanted, all I've ever needed is here in my arms. We don't need to say anything. We don't need to do anything. I just want to be with you and cuddle on the couch or whatever. And that's what we're trying to get across. You know, it's basic. You know, it's like getting you right across. Boom, boom, boom. Here's the hook. Here's the line. Done. And I feel like on these other songs that maybe don't make it into the public consciousness so well as Enjoy the Silence did, like this song here, Love Thieves, you know, that complexity pays off in its own way. And it may not, you know, pay off all the time for all the songs that he's done in that realm. But for this one, I really feel like it does.
I think you make a good point where, you know, when you're having radio hits, you want something people can identify with and understand at least some level of it immediately upon, you know, first listen, or not even, you know, like Enjoy the Silence does. You don't, you don't even have to be a minute into the song to get hooked.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, this takes a while to kind of sink its teeth into you, I think.
Slow burn.
Yeah. I guess I have a question for you, which is, who are the Love Thieves?
So my idea of the Love Thieves is, and I want to bring a lyric that also comes up in the chorus here, is, love will be the death of my lonely soul brothers, but their spirit shall live on in the hearts of all others. So that's the last, you know, two stanzas of the chorus. And I think the Love Thieves are like these people who take this love from other people, you know, like you were saying, they take their love from other people, and those other people become martyrs basically, because you're sort of taking it away from them. And those people then are martyred and have to live in a loneliness, you know. It may be a temporary loneliness, you know, like if we're bringing up an example of like a relationship that only lasts a few months, you know, they're going to be upset when you break up with them, that things are going to end, and then you're going to part ways. But then, you know, a few months later, everything's
back.
You recover and you move on. And I think that he's referencing that love transfer as theft. He's saying that the love thieves are the people who come in and take that love for themselves, martyring these other people in the process, and then move on with their lives and take that love with them as they go. And I think with the song, he's saying that the love thieves are fine as long as they acknowledge what they're doing. And I think that that's what this stanza is saying. Love will be the death of my lonely soul brothers, but their spirit shall live on in the hearts of all others. I think what he's really saying is that as long as you acknowledge that this is what's going on, and as long as you're an adult about it and say, like, I'm doing this, and I'm taking responsibility for that, I think that he's fine with it. And I think that's where the kind of the beauty of the song comes in, where it's like, yeah, this is hard and this sucks, but you know, this is how it works. And as long as you're okay and not acknowledge this, you have to understand that sometimes you're going to be the thief and sometimes you're going to be the martyr, you know, and understanding where you fall on that dichotomy, I think, is important. Mm.
Yeah. And I also get a little, again, thinking about the complexity of the song, in the line where love thieves are specifically mentioned, they're crooked love thieves and you are their jailer.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes me wonder about that jailing aspect. Is it denying giving love to other people? Is part of being a love thief, you take that love, but then you end up keeping it for yourself?
Yeah.
Which in the long run ends up making you lonely.
Yeah.
Because you're getting love, but it doesn't mean much if you can't share
Yeah, he might be saying that, like, the punishment inherent in being the love thieves, because if you want to talk about theft, you know, there's consequences for theft. If you steal somebody's car and they catch you, then you go to jail, you know. And it's like he's trying to say that the penance you're going to pay is the loneliness that you're going to feel in the future when the same thing is done to you. Like, that's you're going to be your punishment. And, you know, when he says you are their jailer, it might just be he might be talking to us. He might be saying, like, you are the ones who are responsible. Like, you, the listener, are the jailers. Hmm. It might not be. He might be talking to some specific person in his life. Because, you know, like we talked about in the previous episode with Fiona Apple, like, you know, Martin Gore tends to write very personably. You know, he writes a little bit from Dave Gahn's perspective, and sometimes he creates, like, fantastical things that don't really, you know, exist in any kind of reality. But most of the time he's writing from personal experience, and you know, so this might be directed at somebody very specific, or it might just be a general thing. But I think what he's trying to get across is that sometimes you're the martyr, sometimes you're the thief. And as long as you understand that either way, you're going to get what you deserve, whether that's the future love or the future punishment. Like, I think that's okay. And I think that's what he's trying to get across to the listener.
So I think overall the Ultra album is one of the most underrated Depeche Mode albums. And I think despite the background chaos going on, there's a lot of really good tracks here. And even in sitting down and figuring out which one of these tracks we were going to talk about, we pretty much arrived at Ultra immediately.
Yeah,
as the album we knew we'd pick something from.
Yeah.
But I think even in terms of finally settling on the Love Thieves, it was a little difficult to sift through because there are a lot of amazing tracks here that people don't hear. I mean, there's four singles on this album, and even in addition to those, there's, you know, some even better ones that have gone unheard.
I think we were discussing we were going to do Sister of Night or
Insight.
I mean, there was a whole bunch of ones that we wanted to do. I mean, really, we just wanted to do the whole record, but this was the one that we attached to the most. I think it's a phenomenal record. And I think that if we were to do a skipped on shuffle version that was just about albums, this whole record. But I think that this song in particular definitely deserves another listen by even Depeche Mode fans who maybe just, you know, pass right over it because it's not one of the ones that, you know, kind of defines the Depeche Mode lexicon, you know.
All right, that's all for this episode of Skipped on Shuffle. Thank you for joining us. You can also follow us online at YouTube, where we'll have performances of the songs that we discuss in these episodes. And you can also find our blog online.
Yeah, if you head to skippedonshuffle.com, you can read our blog, of which there is a Depeche Mode blog entry up there. And then you can also visit us at our social media pages, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. All of that is linked at skippedonshuffle.com.